start. Good morning, everyone. Honorable Kyong, Prime Dr. Lobsang Sangye, Mr. Najib Jang Sahab, Professor S.M. Rashid Sahab, Professor Sajid Sahab, distinguished guests, colleagues, students and friends. On behalf of the Dr. K.R. Narayanan Center for Dalit and Minority Studies, Jamia Millia Islamia, I welcome all of you to the 6th Dr. K.R. Narayanan Memorial Lecture. It is a matter of immense honor for us to welcome and thank Honorable Si Kyong for having kindly agreed to deliver the 6th Dr. K.R. Narayanan Memorial Lecture this morning. Thank you, sir. I would also especially like to welcome and thank our Vice Chancellor, Mr. Najib Jang, for having taken time out of his busy schedule to preside over today's program and for his commitment towards helping us develop our center as an important think tank in the country on issues related to Dalits, minorities, and other marginalized sections of society. The presence of a Center for Dalit and Minority Studies, the first of its kind in any university of the country, underscores Jamia's commitment to the cause of the marginalized. This annual memorial lecture has been instituted by our center to honor the memory of one of the most distinguished personalities India has had in recent times, late Dr. K.R. Narayanan, the 10th President of the Indian Republic, and the ideas of equality and justice that he stood for. Instituting this lecture in his memory is a humble tribute to a man who was steadfast in his commitment to address issues of social justice, whether as a diplomat, politician, or as the President of India. His views on the Constitution, the impact of globalization on the poor and the downtrodden, the atrocities against Dalits, tribals, and women, the concepts of religious tolerance and secularism were born out of this commitment of his. This is what makes him worthy of being celebrated today, even though he is not amongst us anymore. It is a pleasure and privilege for me to introduce our speaker for today, Dr. Lobsang Sangye, Honorable Si Kyong of the Central Tibetan Administration, located at Dharamshala, Himachal Pradesh. Dr. Sangye was elected to the post of the Si Kyong in an unparalleled democratic election in the Tibetan diaspora. With his election to the post, the leadership has been given to a new generation, many who have never lived in Tibet before. Even as his election marks the beginning of a democratic leadership, it is also a reflection of the sustainability of the Tibetan movement beyond the lifetime of the current Dalai Lama. Dr. Sangye completed his BA honours and LLB from Delhi University and obtained his doctorate degree in judicial sciences from the Harvard Law School. He has also been a research fellow and a senior fellow at Harvard. Dr. Sangye is an expert in international human rights law, democratic constitutionalism, and conflict resolution. He has spoken in hundreds of seminars around the world and organized major conferences amongst Chinese, Tibetan, Indian, and Western scholars, including organizing meetings between His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Chinese scholars at Harvard University. Dr. Sangye is an inspiration for the youth amongst the Tibetan diaspora. Speaking with a sense of urgency to the Tibetan youth in his first speech as a Kalantripa, he said, with your permission, sir, I quote, "We need your support, your energy, and your talent to stand tall and march forward to freedom." He went on to add, "The time has come for the younger generation to take a greater leadership role in both internal and international forums. Remember, if we do not, no one will." I'm sure his presence here today will inspire the youth of our university as well. We have had a number of eminent persons who have delivered this memorial lectures in the past. Justice K.G. Balakrishnan, former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, delivered the first lecture on problems of social inequalities and possibilities of judicial intervention. Professor Anil Sadgopal, an eminent educationist activist, delivered the second lecture on equality, education and emancipation, restructuring the inevitable equation. The third lecture was delivered by Sri Tejinder Khanna, the Lieutenant Governor of Delhi, on seeking success, some basic concerns. The fourth by Dr. Abu Saleh Sharif on inclusive development paradigm for India, a modified human development framework. The fifth lecture was by an eminent educationist, Professor Krishna Kumar, on justice in teaching. I'm sure today's lecture, Democracy in Exile, The Case of Tibet, will be equally, if not more, inspiring and eminent. I would now welcome our chief guest to please come and deliver his lecture.
Thank you. Vice Chancellor, Professor Najib Jang, Professor Sajid and Rashid Ji, and the faculty and students of Jamia Millia University. It's a great honor and a privilege to be here to share some thoughts on Tibet. So, first of all, I would like to extend, as we say in India, hearty appreciation, and in Tibetan word, tashi dilek, to all of you, which means good wishes. I would also like to acknowledge Assistant Professor Nagy Ji for being persistent in inviting me here. I just read, and of course knew about Jamia Millia University for a long time, being a DU alum myself, and just shared that Jamia Millia University had a very significant, interesting, and dynamic background. That we started all in 1920 in Aligarh, and with some 20 students in Najib Jang's grandfather's place, then garage, and then moved to Delhi in 1926, and with former President Jaquir Hussain as the chancellor then. So it has seen some tough days. But then the Gandhiji himself was so committed in having this university. And at that time he said, whatever the university needs, I will do it. Even if I need to go with the begging bowls, I will go and raise the funds and do it. And I was told that the Mr. Bajaj had given an open check for the use of Jamia Millia University. So, and I just read, it was in the introduction, Jamia Millia kind of represents, given that past, when things get tough, you know, and then more committed people face it and move forward. And that it seems to be the background of Jamia Millia, and that seems to be the reality or the situation of Tibetan people. Things are quite tough, but then we have persevered for the last 50 years, mainly in India, thanks to the government and generous people of India. And I often say this, that the Tibetan Buddhism is based on Nalanda teaching of Buddhism, which is has its origin in India. And the Tibetan democracy that I'm going to share or talk about is also has its Indian origin, because I'm giving the K.R. Narayan, former president's memorial lecture. He stands for, as introduced, stands for justice and equality, and he cared for Dalits and tribals and women. Similarly, you know, the Dr. B.R. Ambedkar, the founding father of Indian Constitution, and his contribution towards democracy was replicated or copied by the Tibetans in early 60s. Hence, Tibetan democracy is also based on Indian democracy. And then we also follow Gandhi's teaching of Ahimsa, because our movement is based on nonviolence and democracy. These are two uncompromising principles. So if you look at philosophy, if you look at Ahimsa, if you look at Tibetan democracy, Tibetan movement is very much made in India. And then now being myself, born and brought up in India, having studied in Tibetan refugee school subsidized by the Indian government, and in Delhi University where I pursued my BA and LLB, and from there I went on to Harvard Law School. So I'm also born and brought up, so the Tibetan political leadership is also very much an Indian product. So in that sense, Tibetan cause is based on Indian philosophy and led by people born and brought up in India. So it's very much a made in India kind of a cause. So if you succeed, we all succeed together. So Gandhiji led the Indian freedom movement, and Dr. Ambedkarji, Jaquir Hussainji, they all provided leadership at that crucial time. Mm-hmm. And what we are doing from our side, we are committed, we are hardworking, but we are so small in number. So what we really need is 1.2 billion Indians to be behind us. Then we will have both the cause, and the people to move forward. So I want to really express sincere appreciation. Before taking over the political leadership, I knew Indian government and Indian people were very generous to us. But after taking over, more than ever, I've realized that how generous the Indian government has been. And that's why we don't complain that much. But because we say we are Mehman here, and as a Mehman, whatever the host provide us, we will take it. But given a choice, do we want something more politically? Of course. But whatever we are provided, we take it, and no complaints. But we also have requests that Tibet be one of the core issues of India in dealing with China. Because China says Tibet is, along with Taiwan and South China Sea, as core issues. Now, I will briefly talk about Tibetan democracy, which is not much known in the larger world. I got elected last year. And then the Solemnness of the Dalai Lama also decided to transfer all his political authority to the elected leader. Now, the interesting part of the story is, while I was running for the election, I thought I was coming to Dharamsala, to India. I was returning to work under His Holiness Dalai Lama as being both a spiritual and political leader, and to work for the Tibetan people. I never thought that after coming to Dharamsala, I will be told by His Holiness that you are on your own now, you have to take over everything, you know, you have to replace the political leadership. But as a Tibetan, one has to shoulder the responsibility. In the last 15 months, I'm doing the best I can, working very hard, and with the support and solidarity of the Tibetans, inside and outside, and they have rallied around with the transition. It has gone on quite smoothly. Now, how I became a candidate and how I ran the election might be interesting to you. It's a bit of a funny story. So, I became a candidate by default. In normal election, you become a candidate and promise bread, butter, and shelter. Roti, kapra, or makhan. Hum de denge, board mere ko de do. But this is Tibetan movement, so you can't promise bread, butter, and shelter. Tibetans say, I am aapko roti, kapra, makhan dunga, mere ko ye nahi chahiye, mere ko apna desh chahiye, hame apna desh wapas jana hai. So I formulate a strategy. But before that, at that time, that's now almost 2 years ago, the other candidates were quite serious, very serious candidates. Former Kalu Tripa, or the former Prime Minister, Speaker of the Parliament, Deputy Speaker of the Parliament, most seasoned diplomat, and Private Secretary of His Holiness Dalai Lama for more than a decade. So they were the other candidates. And I was the youngest, never worked in Dharamsala before, and spent the last 16 years in America. Now, looking at these candidates, the conventional wisdom was I had 0% chance of winning. So this, when the tough gets going, it comes here. So I asked my friends, my very good friends, I said, you know, what should I do? Because people are mentioning my name, they're circulating my name in websites and internet. Should I run or not? One of my best friends told me, I said, I'm thinking of running because so many people are mentioning my name. Are you sure? And I said, yes. Then what you really need is a graceful exit strategy. And I said, why? Look at other candidates. You have no chance of winning. So first you have to come with a graceful exit strategy, then you run. The second friend I asked, and he said, okay, give me 2 days, I'll call back. And after 2 days he called back and said, he talked to all his friends in Washington DC in Dharamsala, no one is voting for you, so you get the message. And the third friend, I complained, I said, all my friends are talking like this, what should I do? My third friend said, you know, Lobsang, you should run, because you have nothing to lose. So with that encouragement, I ran. So, but then actually, Tibetan population at large were in the mood for change. But then the election became, of course, more serious. It became about the Tibetan cause, and then obviously more about personalities than policies, which is often the case in election. But then, more substantive part of Tibetan democracy is that Tibetans from Australia to Alaska, from Ladakh, Changdang, to New York, to Brussels, everybody voted on single day. Our election rules are very strict. So we have our representative Tembala here, and member of parliament Chojongla here, and our Tibetan local leaders are here. We all witnessed this, we all have practiced this in the last 50 years. For example, the March 20th was the final round of election. In Ladakh, local election officials, Tibetans, they carried the ballot boxes on the backs of yaks and donkeys and climbed the mountains. 18, 19,000, 20,000 feet high. And the nomads came down from the tents to vote. March 20th, mind you, was so cold, so snowy, it was minus 40 degrees. But still, the local official carried the ballot boxes. And then Tibetan nomads and Tibetans came from their tents and voted. Now if you go to Bandra, Tibetan settlement, which is known for being very hot and humid, maybe it might beat the heat of Delhi as well. But Tibetans line up in the school ground for hours to vote. From settlements to settlements to settlements, from Menkot to Belagopi to New York. Uniquely, everybody, they are American citizens, Tibetans there, but they all participate in election so that they could give a mandate to the leader and demonstrate that we are a democracy. Now, this story has its origin in 1959 when His Holiness the Dalai Lama, he was 27 years old, and 80,000 Tibetans, including our parents and our Tibetans who are here, their parents fled Tibet to India. At 27 years old, His Holiness Dalai Lama, we're just talking about many of the students sitting in this room, he had this vision of Tibetan democracy. And first thing he said was, we just lost our country. He said, we have to have a parliament, an elected parliament, so Tibetans should go and vote. Where were the Tibetans? They were the road builders in Sikkim, Manali, and Dalhousie. Sometimes when you enjoy the highway ride of these places, you should remember these were built by Tibetans. So the highway road constructors, on the roadside, they all gathered and said, His Holiness has instructed us to vote and elect our representatives. And they did. So on September 2nd of 1960, we established the first Tibetan parliament. Just a year after we lost our country, we all were refugees. Now again, His Holiness said, well, as former President K.R. Narayanji was for equality and justice, Dalits, tribals, and women, His Holiness said, we need women representation in the parliament. In 1963, second parliament, we had women representation. Now we all know, Switzerland had their women representation only in 1970s. But Tibetans had women representation in 1963. Then he also said, we need a constitution. We have to draft a democratic constitution in 1963. And we looked at the Dr. Ambedkar's constitution of India and copied all those relevant provisions which were helpful to us. And we compiled it and we made it our own. This is a Tibetan constitution. But, His Holiness said, if this is a constitution, if we are going to be democratic, then everybody should be subservient to the constitution. No one is above the law, including me, the Dalai Lama. What we need to do, we need to put a provision which says that Dalai Lama can be impeached. Can you imagine? Tibet, we just lost our country. He is our undisputed leader, spiritual and political leader. Tibetans revere him. Now he wants to put a provision that will impeach him. And then there was a big controversy. How can you even think of impeaching the Dalai Lama? How is it possible? Then there were blames. Who is the translator? Who translated the Indian constitution into English, Tibetan language? Who is the one who is working on it, you know? And a lot of complaints. But in the end, Solomon said, no, 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 this is me. I want this constitution. I want this provision. So we had an impeachment clause in the Tibetan constitution as early as 1963. So that is His Holiness Dalai. So it's a great honor and privilege to come back to, you know, Jammu and Kashmir University following his footsteps, which is my political responsibility also to share with you. He's too humble to share the achievements he has made. But the Tibetan democracy is as per his vision. Then step by step by step, 60s, 70s, 80s, reforms after reforms after reforms. In 1991, we expanded the parliament, we empowered the parliament, parliament elected the cabinet, Kashak then. And in 2001, His Holiness declared, now I want Tibetans to elect their political leader directly, Kalon Trepa. So Kalon Trepa Samdo Rinpoche, whom some of you might know, is again a Gandhian, a very great scholar, and also speaks Shuddha Hindi and Sanskrit. My Hindi is only up to class 8. But he got elected and re-elected in 2006. And 2011, finally, the election round. We all said, this is a crucial election because we are electing political head. And very important, and His Holiness 76 years old at that time, so we all have to engage and involve, and Tibetans all over the world were engaged and involved. And then, 2011, His Holiness said, we are going to separate the church and the state. Institution of Dalai Lama will be our most revered leader, our spiritual leader, and political leadership will be with the Tibetan people. What does it mean? Again, this is another vision. He wanted Tibetan people not rely on an individual solely. He wanted to empower Tibetans by democratizing the system, and the democratic system will carry forward the Tibetan movement. Similar to the Indian National Congress, was democracy was embedded in the institutional mechanism, how it was set up, so that the people will be engaged in the system and democracy will push forward and strengthen and sustain the Tibetan movement. So we are in the new phase of the Tibetan cause, a historic phase, the transition is taking place. Having said that, this transition should not be interpreted as separation or different from the history of Tibet or the tradition of Tibet. Meaning, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, the institution of Dalai Lama, has its origin way back in 13th century. But the political authority was taken over by the 5th Dalai Lama in 1642. From 5th Dalai Lama to 14th Dalai Lama, the Dalai Lamas were both spiritual and political authority. They were the sovereign head. They were the legitimate leader of Tibet. So when 5th Dalai Lama passed away, Desi Sangye Gyatso, Desi, this is very important, Si. My title is Sikong. Si means political leadership. Desi Sangye Gyatso took over. And from 7th Dalai Lama on, Sikyong takes over each time a Dalai Lama passes away. Meaning the term Sikyong has a historical basis. So 5th Dalai Lama to 14th Dalai Lama, they were the legitimate sovereign head of Tibet and Tibetan people. So when 14th Dalai Lama devolved his political authority, along with the political authority, he transferred history of Tibet. He transferred the legitimacy of Tibet. Hence, Dharamsala-based Tibet administration and the title Sikyong has historical continuity and political legitimacy. This is very important. It should not be interpreted as just this separation of church and state. They're two different entities. They are part of the same as far as history is concerned, legitimacy is concerned. Now, how does the Dharamsala administration work? It functions like any other government. We have 7 ministries or 7 departments, foreign, under which we have around 12 semi-embassies or offices of Tibet around the world, one in Delhi, and in New York, in Geneva, in Moscow, and Taiwan, and Tokyo. And then under education department, I also hold the education portfolio. So we have around 30 plus high school, primary school, and middle schools, around 30,000 or so children educated all over. I got my education, and many of us got our education in Tibetan Refugee School. And then finance takes care of money, and our budget is limited in the sense it's only $22 million a year. It's 120 some crores. It's less than one of the major embassies here in Delhi. But we make do with that budget to run, to care of 150,000 people around the world, their education, their health, elderly people. We manage to take care of them. Why? We all take pay cuts. I've shared this often, but maybe I will share with you here as well. I had a job at Harvard Law School for 7 years. So I left that job, I left America to come serve in India as Tibetan people. So my salary now is less than my DA, daily allowance at Harvard, a day. It's around 70,000 rupees a month. I travel by second class train. Tonight I'm going to do that. By Puja Express to Dharamsala. I travel by economy class. Now why I say this, because if I get only this much of, you know, perks, then all the rest of the staff members, 1,000 employees, get a lot less than me. So this is a labor of love. This is a cause. This is the sacrifice the Zakir Hussainji and the Gandhiji felt when Jamia Millia is the Islamic University established. We don't have money, but this vision is good. This cause is good. We all have to commit ourselves. So, Tibetans, the younger generation has taken over. Younger generation is given the responsibility. The elder generation have worked so hard under brilliant leadership of His Holiness Dalai. And the elder generation Tibetans have left a rich and strong legacy. Now it becomes the challenge of the younger generation to continue the legacy of the elder generation and build on the hard work of the elder generation. And from our part, we are doing our bit by making contribution. So not just me, a friend of mine from America has returned, left his job. Another one left her job as a senior PR official in a billion-dollar project in Montreal in Canada. She's here in Dharamsala. Someone has closed his shop in San Francisco to come work in Dharamsala. So we have Tibetan youth coming from London, coming from Minnesota, coming from Australia to come to realize the vision of His Holiness and fulfill the aspirations of the Tibetan people in Tibet. Now, in Tibet, I'm sorry to say I don't have good news to share, because the situation in Tibet is getting much, much, much more difficult. 89 Tibetans have committed self-immolation. 89 Tibetans. 89 Tibetans have set themselves on fire. They burn themselves. It's going to be 100, most likely. And the Time magazine says, this is the least reported news in the world. Top 10 least reported news in the world. There was one self-immolation in Tunisia, and many say that led to the Arab Spring. That led to the international media going and covering it. That led to the international going there and intervening to bring justice. 2 weeks later, the president of Tunisia, Ben Ali, left. Tahrir Square happened in Egypt. It continues to happen now. And they say one Tunisian self-immolation was the catalyst for Arab Spring. 89 Tibetans have burned themselves. how come there's one standard to cover the news, one standard to support an issue, and there's another standard to support? So that's why former president's aspiration to Gandhi is also equality and justice. What Tibetans seek is justice. What we seek is equal treatment. Not only after going to Tibet, even as a movement, we want equal acknowledgement, equal recognition, equal support. Nothing more, nothing special. So that is why this platform is very important. So I feel very honored and privileged because I get to share, even though it's a sad chapter in Tibet's history, the reality in Tibet. Now the Chinese government blame us for troubles in Tibet. They say, oh, self-immolation is instigated by people from outside, us and me. And they all want to question the self-immolation itself. They want us to focus on the action. And some people often ask me, how do you interpret this? But I say, yes, action is important, but it's secondary. The primary reasons why people are committing self-immolation, the causes, what's forcing them to do it? Life is precious. If you slap me, maybe I'll slap you back. At least I'll say, ouch. Who would give up one's life just like that? The Indian freedom fighters gave up their lives. Why? Just because they wanted to die? No. They believed in the cause, they were forced to. Gandhiji went to prison. Why? He was forced to. That's the only way he could highlight the issue of India at that time. Similarly, Tibetans are forced to be in the streets, protest. What are the causes for self-immolation? Continuing occupation of Tibet by PRC. Political repression. Political repression. For example, here I can speak before you. In Tibet, if you shout one slogan in the streets of Lhasa, the capital city, human rights, just two words. If you just say human rights, raise your hand. Immediately you will be arrested. You will be tortured. Sometimes you disappear. Even to have a copy of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights could land you in trouble. If you paste a poster on a wall, you will be arrested. There is no room for hunger strike. There is no freedom of speech or room for any form of protest. Hence, Tibetans are saying, self-immolation is one way left. Now, economic marginalization in Lhasa, in Tibet, towards Tibetan people. 70% of shop, restaurants and hotels in Lhasa, the capital city, are owned or run by Chinese. In fact, there's a picture, it's available if you Google it, it's on the internet. There's a signboard outside a Chinese shop in Lhasa. Lhasa means, in Tibetan word, Lhasa means land of gods. Lha means God, Sa means land of gods. It's precious to us. Now in a Chinese store in Lhasa, there is a signboard which says, if you want a job, apply. But if you are Chinese, we give you 50 renminbi a day. If you are Tibetan, we give you 30 renminbi a day. How would you feel if there is a signboard outside Jami Melia which says that if you are Chinese, we give you 50 rupees a day. If you are Indian, we give you 30 rupees a day. Blatant discrimination. Now, cultural assimilation, religious freedom. If you are caught with a picture of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, I'm sorry to say, Vice Chancellor, you have a picture of His Holiness in your office, you will be arrested. Not only that, Chinese government established what they call Democratic Management Committee in 7,000 plus monasteries in Tibet Autonomous Region. That they have declared. What does this committee, which is called democratic, does? they are the ones which allows you to stay in the monastery or not. You are made to look at the picture of Dalai Lama and spit on it. Criticize. If you don't, you will be arrested. You will be expelled from the monastery. Now, Tibetan language. The Jamme Mela University, the need for it was felt so that the minorities and others could preserve the language and culture. At university level, Chinese is the medium of instruction in Tibet. At high school level, medium of instruction is Chinese. Middle school level, medium of instruction is Chinese. Now, even now, they're imposing at primary school level. That's why it's children are in the streets protesting. So, and environment destruction. Now, it's just not an issue of Tibet. If you look at the environment, it is connected to whole the Himalayan belt, South Asia and Asia as a whole. Tibet is called the third pole in the world. After Antarctica and Arctic, Tibet has the third highest reserve of ice. The difference being, when the ice of Tibet melts, the Tibetan plateau, it turns into fresh water. Hence, the 10 largest rivers of Asia flow from Tibet. Of course, nowadays, yesterday you read that the Chief Minister of Tamil Nadu and Karnataka are talking about how to share Kauri River. Not just that. Tibet's river, Satluj River, it flows, it originates in Tibet, goes through Kashmir to Pakistan. Indus River starts in Tibet, goes through again India to Pakistan. Indus River is special because the 60% of Indus River, fresh water of Indus River, is the snow that melts in Tibet. Brahmaputra River, from Tibet to India to Bangladesh. Now, what is the significance? Whenever you read that 1/3 of Bangladesh is under flood, is flooded, it has direct relationship to deforestation that is taking place in Tibet. You cut the trees, and environmentalists will say, when there's a rain, monsoon season, there's a landslide, because of the silting, riverbed rises, it causes flood downstream. The flood in Bangladesh has direct relationship to deforestation in Tibet. Mekong and Salween River, the famous Mekong River, which flows all the way to Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam. Yangtze River, the famous Yangtze River of China. Yellow River, all of it starts in Tibet. So Tibet is environmentally vital for Asia. Of course, all these countries are drinking Tibet's water. And as a traditional steward of Tibet's plateau, we are happy to share Tibet's natural resources, including water. Because as the Garshin, and as per Buddhism, we respect the natural flow of rivers. And we don't have water sharing issue so far. But when the CEO of Bangladesh, Mamata Didi, raises the issue about Tista River with Bangladesh, then we are also tempted to charge something, you know, about our Brahmaputra River, or Indus River, or Satluj River. But historically, we have been tolerant and observant of natural flow of rivers. Now, what is the problem? The problem is the Chinese government and the companies are building not just 1, 2, but 10, 20 dams per river. Thereby affecting the natural flow of rivers. Thereby affecting the livelihood of millions of people in India and in Asia, because those who survive on agriculture and fishery, they have to have natural flow of rivers. Now the worst part is yet to come. All these dams, the construction are questionable. Whether they are engineerically sound or scientifically sound or not is to be seen. They're building it for hydropower, for quick money. What will happen down the line, we don't know. That's why you read in newspaper, complaints from Arunachal Pradesh and Ladakh that the river has decreased now. Why it's decreasing? Because of the dam? And then there's some Indian media reports that one river is diverted upstream towards China instead of coming down to India. This is being reported. And there's some basis in the sense China has 20% of world population, but only 12% of fresh water. Meaning the 8%, or rather 40% of the China's population, they lack fresh water. So 1.3 billion, 40%, we are looking at 500 million people. They need fresh water. So one has to be skeptical and suspicious whenever you read reports that the rivers that's flowing to India, it's decreasing in quantity. So India's natural resources, India's security is at stake as well. Now, through Indian media, you read that China has built 6 airfields. They have already built 5 airfields. There are 630 or so airports, but airfields, military airfields, on the Tibetan side. They're building one more. They have already got railway line to Lhasa. Now they want to connect the railway line to Shigatse, to Sikkim, to Nepal, and to the border of Bangladesh and Burma as well. And the highway is already built to the borders of India. And seaport in Pakistan, Sri Lanka, maybe in Myanmar. So when you talk about security of India and Tibet, it's not just in the Himalayan mountains. It's connected all around India. And we were also told the Indian pilgrims who go to Tibet for pilgrimage, that they have to pay for visa, apply for visas. When Tibet was free, we always respected pilgrims from India coming to Tibet. There was hardly any sentry post between the two. Now there are 23 military divisions on the other side, reportedly, and only 11 or so military divisions from Indian side. Hence, Tibet's issue is also issue of India and national security of India. And let me conclude by saying that situation in Tibet continues to be tragic. More repression and more repression. For example, Tibet, journalists are not allowed. Foreign tourists are not allowed nowadays. Even Tibetans who come from outside the Lhasa, if you don't have ID of Lhasa, you are expelled. Even Tibetans in Lhasa, the capital city, if you have an ID, resident card, every 5 minutes there's a check post. Normally, if it takes 5 or 10 minutes to buy vegetables, it takes half an hour, 1 hour nowadays. You have to go through several check posts. There's a military clampdown. It's unfortunate and sad. But the Tibetan spirit continues to be strong. After 50 years of separation, Tibetans young and old, nomads or farmers, students or teachers, women or men, all are protesting in the streets of Tibet. And we in exile also are supporting them, and we have to. This is our sacred duty. And often people say, do you think it's possible that Tibetans can take on the increasingly powerful China, next superpower, militarily, economic, very powerful? And we say, why not? Because we have done it before, and we'll do it again. 13th Dalai Lama had to flee Tibet in 1907 to India. And we worked hard, and we managed the return of 13th Dalai Lama to Tibet in 1911 and 12. We have done it before, we'll do it again. From the soil of India. So with that note, I just want to once again appreciate feel a great privilege and honor to be here. Being myself born and brought up in India and educated in India, following the Gandhian principle of Ahimsa, based on Ambedkar's constitution of Tibetan democracy, we are very much made in India and supported by India and Indian people. So we are all together, whether you want it or not. If you succeed, it will be our success. And let's make it one more chapter in the history of India, in the history of Asia, in the history of the world, that people who are discriminated against do get their days, do enjoy justice, do enjoy equality, as per the vision and the principles of former President K.R. Narayanji, Gandhiji, and the founding fathers of Jamia Millia University. Thank you.